The Guardian.
Welcome to another Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week, we rev up with Drive director Nicholas Winding Refn and reveal why the man without a driving license revels in cinematic car chases. And from Fifth Gear to Top Gear, we delve into the New York 70s disco fashions of Halston in a well-tailored documentary, Ultra Suede. I meet the director, Whitney Sudler-Smith. Zan Brooks joins me to review some of the week's other releases, including Tom Hardy in Warrior and Vincent Landon in Mademoiselle Chambon. This podcast is automatic, systematic, high dramatic. Why? It's Film Weekly.
There's 100,000 streets in this city. You don't need to know the route. You give me a time and a place, I give you a 5-minute window. Anything happens in that 5 minutes and I'm yours. No matter what. Anything happens a minute either side of that and you're on your own. Do you understand?
That's Man of the Moment Ryan Gosling as the driver in Drive. The film's creator, Nicholas Winding Refn, is a director with all the cinematic firepower implied by that double-barreled name. Danish by birth, raised in New York, his dad works for Lars von Trier, and he made his name in his native Denmark with a gutsy and violent debut, Pusher. It's a cult success now, leading to a trilogy of films under that title and a current British remake underway. But most recently, Nicholas has made two films here in the UK, the eerie, surreal warrior drama Valhalla Rising and the equally surreal and violent Bronson with actor Tom Hardy in his breakthrough central role. More of him later. Drive, however, is a different beast. It tells the story of a movie stunt driver played by Ryan Gosling. The film tracing his life on the edge of the LA criminal underworld, where a man with a need for speed is rapidly running out of road. Nicholas Winding Refn, how wonderful to see you, wonderful to have you back on Film Weekly after a gap of years. I think the last Pusher film was the last time I had you on the show. So it's brilliant to see you. And now you are crowned Best Director at the Cannes Film Festival. I was so proud to see you getting up there.
Thank you very much. And it's always great to be back. It's kind of weird that I spent the following years making two films in England and I never got on the show. Then I have to go to America to get me back on the show. But it's always nice to be back.
We wanted Ryan Gosling, really, but we couldn't get him.
You got the real thing.
Yeah,
me.
We
did. I am the real Ryan Gosling.
I was a big fan of Bronson. I was a big fan of Valhalla Rising as well. I liked them both. I thought the films spoke for themselves, Nicholas. I didn't need to come and get you. But now you're Best Director at the Cannes Film Festival. To be honest, I mean, I sort of couldn't believe it. I mean, it's a very stylish film. It's kind of a genre film. It's a very cool choice of them to make you Best Director. I'm impressed by the Cannes jury.
So was I. I mean, look, I mean, a lot of people ask me, what did it feel like? Did you expect it? And the answer is no. And it felt great, you know. But just being in competition was kind of bizarre because, you know my life story so well and how many ups and downs I've had. So you never figure that it would end up like that.
Yeah.
And with a movie that I ended up making in Los Angeles about, you know, Hollywood, going to Cannes with it was certainly a great experience.
Yeah, it surprised me as well that it's a film about a guy who can drive a car, because I know that famously you can't drive a car.
I can't even drive a car. I failed 8 times.
You've actually taken it and failed.
Failed 8 times.
Is that are you giving up now?
Completely. I will never drive a car because also I've been in 2 car crashes in England. So while I was making Bronson, I was in 2 car crashes. And no, it's actually when I made Miss Marple. I feel like I'm probably.
It's my favorite Miss Marple of all of them. I've got to tell you. I've never seen one, by the way. I think you should make Downton Abbey next because believe me, that needs some funking up.
Yeah, isn't that EastEnders? I think I'm going to be up for it. No, I've been in car crashes. So I've always been very afraid of cars. And I was hit by a car when I was little. And I remember on Miss Marple, I had 2 crashes back to back. So,
and Miss Marple, the cars go about 3 miles an hour in Miss Marple.
You wouldn't think. And then I go to Hollywood and do a movie about stunt driving, and nothing ever happens, thank God. And then the first thing happens when I arrive in London this morning that we're hit by a car again.
I heard.
So I must attract metal in this city.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if Drive was you kind of exercising your demons against the motor, the automobile industry.
It was a way to get me out of the automobile industry.
Was it that
industry.
Stephen King film, the Christine?
Which yeah, is
the
where they attract.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Attract metal, as I say.
But you've got some very cool cars in the film.
Yes. I mean, the whole idea was because what's interesting here was a movie that was going to be a studio movie. It was developed by Universal, and Universal decided not to make it. So all the studio passed on it. So we actually ended up getting independent financing for it, which then actually brought me back to where I usually work, which is, you know, here's X amount of money, here's X amount of days. You go above that, there's nothing else.
Yeah.
So it was almost back to my comfort zone.
So it was kind of a good choice for you, because it seemed to me at the time when I heard you were working with Ryan Gosling and Kerry Mulligan, Ron Perlman, big Hollywood names in an indie kind of way. I know they're kind of boiling, bubbling under. But it was like, so you, it almost felt like a kind of old, it's an old 70s style film. Was it almost like kind of going back to that kind of, you know, heyday of American indie filmmaking? Did you feel like a young Boxcar Bertha filmmaker? Did you feel like a young Turk?
Well, it did, because one of the reasons why I wanted to do it was also I decided that I wanted to go to Los Angeles and have the Hollywood experience of, you know, the European coming from the outside world, which also meant I had to live in a certain way. I wanted a house with a swimming pool and an orange tree and had to be in the hills. And we cut the movie at my house. You know, Carey Mulligan moved in because she didn't have a place to live and lived with me and my wife and our kids. And Ryan basically had a key to the house, so he would always come by to hang out. And all the rehearsals were done in my house. My house became like the center of, so it was very much that kind of 70s filmmaking where it was a commune of people just getting together. And I mean, we were basically doing a movie, but we just didn't have any drugs around.
Really?
That would be, you know, the final draw.
That would be proper.
They would be gone real retro.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe some prostitutes in bikinis, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but that will almost be too commercialized. That was more like late 70s, early 80s. That was film concept. Business and kind of corporation kicked in. This was like true kind of 70s kind of way where just people would get together in a room and say, let's try to make a movie, you know. Hossein Amini, who had been adapting the book for years, even before Ryan and I came on board, moved into the house and stayed with us when we were working on the script.
It's interesting, when we did have Ryan on the show recently for Blue Valentine, I mean, that was a project that took a long time to make. He was attached, he wasn't attached then, and the making of it was slow and kind of organic as well, and he worked very closely with Michelle Williams and his director, Derek. It seems to me that brings out the best of him, because it seems to me that that's the way he's worked with you as well, that he actually is there hanging around while making the movie.
Well, any actor gets more out of being part of the creative process from the origin to the end, you know, and not just, and because I was cutting the movie at my house, it was an open door for everybody to walk in and look at dailies or see what Matt Newman and I were cutting and hear what kind of music we would be playing on, and even sitting sometimes and them being our test audience. You would cut the scene, show it to them and hear what they react to. And when you do that with actors, especially in America, where they're so used to not being part of the creative process, more just hired guns, unless you're a superstar, that then changes everything. But, you know, being part of that creativeness and then shooting, as I shoot my films chronologically ordered, they could actually see everything happen in front of us. And that made everybody just contribute a lot more.
Yeah.
And of course, it gives them much more personal satisfaction than just being a puppet that comes in and walks out.
I've just come back from the Venice Film Festival where I saw Kerry Mulligan in the film Shame, in which she plays the sister of Michael Fassbender, and she has got nowhere to live. She goes to live with him in New York in his flat. Now, you said she had nowhere to live. She went to live with... What is that with Kerry Mulligan? Can't she find a house, the poor girl?
I think her taste in real estate is difficult. So we took her in. I mean, basically, when I gave her the part, she called and said she had no place to stay. And I was like, look, why don't you come and live with us? Yeah.
So you just moved to LA?
No, I've been here for a while.
You're just new here?
Mm-hmm.
That's Benicio's father.
Where is he?
He's in prison.
Oh.
What do you do?
I drive.
Like a limo driver?
No, like for movies.
Oh. You mean all the car chases and stuff?
Yeah.
When you gave her the part, you'd seen her in An Education, I assume.
No, I'd never seen anything she's done.
Oh, you didn't even know who she was.
I knew of her, And I basically was looking for a completely different kind of actress. I was looking for Latino actress because in Salas's book, a lot of the novel takes place in the Mexican world. Mm. And so I was looking for Latino actress, and I would meet all the great Latino actresses in Los Angeles. I mean, the powerhouse of talent is enormous. But I couldn't make up my mind. I couldn't decide, even though I had great, famous, even very famous people, I could not decide.
From Salma all the way down?
All the way from Salma and all the way down and all the way up even.
You know, there's up from Salma? There's no up from Salma, come on.
Actually, that's true. She's the peak of the mountain. But everything from her going down was willing to be part of the movie and would be done terrific work. I mean, dynamite work. I mean, Salma is probably one of the best actresses around.
Yeah, no, I think
and
she's
great. So I just couldn't make a decision. And then I got a call from her agent asking if I would meet with her. And I was like, sure. I mean, apparently she, like Ryan, had seen my films and wanted to talk about doing something. And I was like, absolutely, she's more than welcome to come. But A, I haven't seen any of her movies. And B, I don't have anything, you know, I don't have anything to offer her right now. But my wife had seen An Education and said she was so good. And my mother had seen it and they were like, you know, you should meet up. And
I love that you still listen to your mother.
Come on, any true artist.
Always
behind a great man is a better woman. And she came one morning, and the minute she walked the door, I said, "You're it. You got it."
That's great. I think she's great. I think she really is versatile.
She is. And also because I realized what I wanted to make a movie about is that I wanted to make a movie about a man who protects a woman and what he's willing to do for her. And she reminded very much of my own wife. Mm-hmm. And so everything, the card house fell into place.
Yeah.
And then she said she didn't have any place to stay. And I said, come on in. Take be part in. Of us.
So you're not only a refined director now, but you're also a sort of a charitable home for homeless actors.
I take anybody in anytime, anywhere.
There you go. Offers on a postcard.
But she did have, you know, she had things to do. She would always bake carrot cakes.
Right. Well, that's very useful. Something
so
in return.
So she was both actress / driver once in a while when I needed a ride.
Of course.
And then she would provide cooking.
How's her carrot cake? The Kerry Mulligan carrot cake?
Super.
You recommend it?
I would recommend it's a 10 out of 10.
I'm gonna get her to bake us a cake here.
You got her to move in first.
And just before we go, Ryan, obviously, I know you've become really good friends with Ryan and you're working on some other projects with him.
Well, actually, Ryan and I are telekinetic.
Right. We could have got him here today.
He's here. He's talking right, through me. We are actually the same person. I mean, right now, unfortunately, he would be here, but he's shooting in Los Angeles as we speak, so he couldn't. But what was interesting about our working relationship was that we became telekinetic. We can read each other's thoughts. You know, even Stanford University has approached us about doing like an experiment together.
Really?
So it's
like a Project NIM kind of thing?
Well, it's kind of taking on its own life. When we pass on it because none of us has time. But the whole idea of telekinetic, you know, artistic talk was really wild to them. And we were like two person in one mind.
Because you're going to do a sci-fi. You're doing Logan's Run. That's a kind of sci-fi.
Well, first we're doing a movie at Christmas called Only God Forgives. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to do a remake of Logan's Run afterwards.
Brilliant. Well, I can't wait because I think, you know, you clearly bring out the best in each other. And I think he's a terrific actor. As they say, he's not only in Drive this week, he's in Crazy Stupid Love. That shows his kind of, his chops in all genres.
He's the best.
Yeah.
He's the best.
Brilliant. Is he saying that or is that you saying that?
That's us saying that about each other.
Nicholas Quentin Ruffin, Ryan Gosling and Kerry Mullins' Carrot Cakes. We thank you. And for Drive, Nicholas, brilliant to see you back on such top form.
Thank you.
And the stylish and super cool Drive is on general release from this Friday, the 23rd of September. And we've got a superb Drive-related prize to give away, including a copy of the excellent soundtrack, some toothpicks, you'll understand that when you see the movie, a very exclusive pair of leather driving gloves, a great prize, plus the novel by James Salas on which the film was based. All you've got to do to win is message us on our Facebook page, Film Weekly Fans, that's us. You can find us on Facebook. Message us with the winner before next Wednesday, the 28th of September. Now, what we want to know is the man who composed the soundtrack to this Cannes Best Director winning film Drive is Cliff Martinez. He also composed the music to another big Cannes success. Which film was that? Now, here's a man who can drive you round the bend. Zan Brooks joins me to run the rule over the week's big releases. Welcome back, Zan. Careful how you corner.
Yeah, I'd never go above 30.
Oh, good. Nice and safe. Zan, we'll talk about Drive a bit. Then I can tell you about Crazy Stupid Love, because Ryan Gosling's in that as well. Then we mentioned Tom Hardy earlier. He's in a film called Warrior, which you can tell me about. Cage fighting, I believe. I see you've got your gloves off. Yep. And then we'll come together to discuss Mademoiselle Chambon, a bit of a French fancy at the end, if you like. But Drive, Nicholas Winding Refn won Best Director at Cannes, and here comes Drive in all its kind of 80s pastiche glory. Is that something that appealed to you?
Yeah, it did. This was my, I guess, my guilty pleasure of the Cannes Film Festival. It arrived quite late. Everyone kind of knew it wasn't going to win the top prize, because I guess it is a unashamed B-movie.
Yeah.
It's a little bit junky. It's a bit of a pastiche.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as Nicholas said, he was even surprised that it was in competition at all.
Yeah, but I think we kind of needed it at that point of the circuit. And I guess, you know, my one suspicion about it is that it's not much more than a pastiche of Walter Hill and Michael Mann and maybe a bit of Melville's Le Samurai in there.
There's always a bit of Melville's Le Samurai, the sense of that kind of smiling,
serene loner who can kill you as soon as look at you and drive cars really fast. And yet it has stayed with me, which makes me think there's probably more under the bonnet than I was initially giving it credit for. I mean, it's a film of atmosphere.
Yeah.
And the atmosphere is brilliantly maintained.
Absolutely.
That kind of torpid sense of LA under sort of slate grey skies.
Yeah, great LA movie, actually.
Yeah, where it is just kind of strip malls and freeways and totally impersonal, totally this kind of anonymous environment that's kind of thrumming with menace and these great explosions of violence that erupt from the drama.
And I think the fact that he is a movie stunt driver as well, so you've got this kind of make-believe LA that's going on that he's sort of part-time involved in. But the real LA you sense is, in fact, what we're seeing is probably the stuff that's under the bonnet of LA, the shiny exterior being the movie business, and then underneath you've got this kind of criminal underworld.
Yeah, and that sense of LA as being, I can't remember who said it, something like, you know, 500 neighbourhoods in search of a centre, and the sense that there's no...
Who said that?
I don't know, maybe it was me.
Maybe I just coined it.
And just the sense that there's nowhere that's real, that everybody's just kind of rattling around.
There's no anchor, there's sort of no
moral centre to any of this.
Yeah, and that's what it definitely feels like. It kind of reminded me slightly of the feel that Jackie Brown has. I know that's completed, but that kind of, you know, malls and cars going and no one really knows where they are.
I do find it
a very bleak movie, though, and maybe that's what stays with you. I think it's quite nihilistic, really. If for all its pastiche, I think what it's saying is quite cold-hearted.
What is it saying, do you think?
I'm not really sure what it's saying. I think that's probably why I don't think it's a great movie. I love watching it. I'm really pleased that it's definitely my kind of film of the week, and I'm pleased to be offering a competition in it and talking to the director. I'm not sure that... I think it's sort of saying that the good and the bad all end unhappily.
Maybe. And if there's another criticism, it might be a little bit too much a movie informed by other movies. It's a movie about a certain type of movie.
Yeah.
You know, the criticism that's always levelled at Tarantino. And yet, for all that... I think that even if you haven't seen any of this back catalogue, the kind of the 1980s, To Live and Die in LA, Thief, films like that, you can still get a lot from this. It's totally confident. It's incredibly sure-footed. And he is, you know, I think almost deservedly won Best Director at Cannes, because this is a director's film. This is a man behind the wheel who knows where he's going and doesn't take a wrong turn.
Like the critics. We, the critics who sit in the driver's seat, who know where we're going but don't know how to get there.
No, it was usually the other way around. Usually in the trunk.
It was Kenneth Tynan that said that, but I think he said it better.
You can coin that one too.
Maybe I'll just say fuck. He said that too.
He did. He said that on a BBC Breakfast, didn't he?
Nicholas went to Breakfast, and Kenneth Tynan was the first person to say it on the BBC.
Yeah, yeah. So it all comes together.
I like what we're doing there.
Full circle.
Ryan Gosling, who's the star, who I think brilliant. It kind of reminded me of Steve McQueen in both The Getaway and in Bullet, obviously, in Drive. But he's in Crazy Stupid Love, showing his kind of versatility, because this is a rom-com, and he does play a very, very cool man in Crazy Stupid Love.
Yeah.
Do you know what it's about?
I don't. Is it about love?
A little bit, and how crazy and stupid it is.
Right, okay. And with Ryan Gosling.
Yeah.
Guess what? My wife is having an affair with
David Lindhagen. David Lindhagen, I know. How do I know that?
I don't know.
I'm a total stranger. How would I know something so intimate about your wife?
David Lindhagen screwing your wife, too?
No. Do you want to know why I know that, Cal?
Okay.
Because it's all that I've heard, Cal, for the past two nights. It's all anybody's heard. You're going around and you're like badgering people with this sad sack, loser, sob story, and I don't understand why.
No, I don't need this crap.
No, sit down.
All right.
Also starring Steve Carell, also starring Julianne Moore, also starring the great Emma Stone.
She's brilliant.
I really like Emma Stone. She's my kind of hot young, she's really cool, actually. Really good cast, actually. Marisa Tomei's in there as well. Much of the way that Drive has Albert Brooks and all these kind of B-pop players. Everyone turns up, you think, oh, that's a face I'm familiar with.
Yeah.
Crazy Stupid Love, you've got Steve Carell, who, guess what, he plays a bit of a loser.
Does he?
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't like Steve Carell.
Do you not? Why not?
Because he's just always the same.
Because he's a loser. You don't like the losers.
I don't like loser characters that much.
You don't. You're
quite, I don't mind them once.
You're quite Nietzschean.
Yeah, I am. I like a cool character.
Yeah.
I like a drive man. And I like the Gosling because he plays the kind of cool guy that has to educate nerdy Steve Carell into kind of dressing right, how to kind of get rid of his Gap jeans and kind of. I actually quite like this one because it's sort of. There's one bit that Ryan Gosling says to Steve Carell, be better than the Gap. That's his mantra, be better than the Gap. And I was like, wow.
That's setting your sights quite low, isn't it?
Did Gap pay to kind of be involved in that or not? As a kind of negative.
But this is supposedly a good thing. If you can be better than the Gap, you've really made it.
Yeah, you've made it and you're smartened up and then you'll kind of discover your manhood.
I always say be better than Primark.
Yeah, you would, absolutely. You aren't, though.
I know, but, you know, one day.
One day you might be. He instructs Steve Carell on how to kind of chat up girls, and they go to bars, and Ryan Gosling is the player. He's the puller. He's the kind of guy, he can always get a girl. The one girl he can't get, though, is Emma Stone, smart lawyer. So in one storyline, you've got Ryan trying to get it with Emma Stone. And when they do eventually...
How old is Emma Stone? She's about 18. How can she be smart lawyer?
I think she's 24 like that. She's the kind of trainee lawyer. She's just going to the bar, in all senses. And then Steve Carell and Julianne Moore are getting divorced because she's been unfaithful to him, and now he's trying to kind of get one back on her by being learned by Ryan Gosling. The Steve Carell, Julianne Moore stuff, I was a bit like, not interested in. The Ryan Gosling, Emma Stone stuff is fantastic. There's a really beautiful... You know when Ryan Gosling was in Blue Valentine, also showing his chops?
He's had a great year, hasn't he?
He's been fantastic. And that's the kind of indie, they did that really naturalistic indie kind of ukulele strumming scene with Michelle Williams. He's got another one, but in this mainstream comedy, he's got this one with Emma Stone where he takes his top off and she's like, wow. I was a bit like, wow, to be honest with you. Do you know what? I used to have a man crush on Brad Pitt. I used to think if I could turn, it would be for Brad Pitt. I've changed now.
You changed.
I'm transferring allegiances to the Gosling.
Brad must be devastated.
I think he is right now. You know, I know because he's in Richmond, isn't he? Popping into Halfords. This is what he's going to take this podcast out of his ears.
Give us a call, Brad. We can maybe patch it up.
Yeah, let's work. You can explain to me the Tree of Life, and then I'll go. But there's a lovely Gosling shots of Gosling's little down. I always think of a little goose, you know, a little baby goose with down
sexy
back.
Sexy goose.
And that's what Gosling's got. He's got a fluffy downy bit on his back in this film.
That sounds kind of repulsive.
I love this film. Love is Crazy and Stupid.
Yeah.
Do you know what? This is really good, and then there's the ending. The ending is terribly Richard Curtis-y, public displays of all that nonsense. Until that moment, it was really fun, and the Gosling and the Stone are great together. I think they're two really stars here to stay. She is almost like the young Julianne Moore. It's kind of amazing. She could become Julianne Moore, who is brilliant. Julianne Moore, not a very good role. She's brilliant in it.
So if you had to choose between one Gosling or the other this week, which one would you go for?
Well, I've got to go for Drive, really, because I'm cool and hard.
Right.
But, you know, I do think if you're going to go... they're very flip-sidey films. They're both kind of LA movies, actually.
Yeah.
And as I said, one's the shiny bonnet, one's the shiny body, and the other one is rightly kind of what's hiding in the boot or under the bonnet. Crazy, Stupid Love. I enjoyed it. Now, Zan, I mentioned Tom Hardy because he was in Nicholas Winding Refn's film Bronson, sort of resurrected his career, really, a strange performance. And he's in Chinka Taylor Soldier Spy at the moment. And he's currently in a film called Warrior.
He is in a film called Warrior.
Who's he with in this?
He is with the very good Australian actor Joel Edgerton, who's also having a good year because he was in Animal Kingdom.
Oh, that was very good, wasn't it?
Which is great.
But he's not the guy that was in... No, that's Sam Worthington who was in Avatar.
Sam Worthington who was in Avatar, yeah. You think they all look the same, don't you?
Those Australians. Yeah, they're all upside down. So let's have a listen to Tom Hardy and Joel Edgerton in Warrior.
Fenroy, give me some ice. And call that Puerto Rican kid. If he's here in 20 minutes, he gets $200.
You all fight him.
Do me a favor, guy. Go back to your bag. We don't need anybody else getting hurt. Take a walk.
All I'm saying is I'm happy to keep your boy warm for you.
You ever fought before?
Yeah.
You get tuned up in here, it's on you, Tom.
Sure, no problem, no problem.
Let's go. All right, let's go. Oh, hey, watch that team.
Want to be a hero? All right. Peace.
Oh, all right. Easy.
You owe me $200.
Wow. Those are two hard boys.
Yeah, you wouldn't get in the ring with either of them, would you?
I certainly wouldn't.
You really wouldn't. This, I guess, is, you know, it's a little bit like The Fighter, which was out earlier this year.
Yeah, the clips look like, look like The Fighter, because they're two brothers, aren't
they? It's the two warring brothers. Joel Edgerton plays Brendan, who's used to be a fighter but is now a respectable teacher, but he's, you know, falling behind on the mortgage. He's a harassed dad who needs to get back in the ring to turn his life around. And then you've got Tom Hardy as Tommy, who's the Marine just back from the front line and a war hero. And the two brothers don't like each other. There's you know, a lot of skeletons in the closet. There's grievances that need to be aired. They're both fighting for money, and wouldn't you know it, they're on a collision course at this martial arts kind of cage fighting
contest yeah. thing. A bit of some Karate Kiddie type thing.
A little bit Karate Kid, but without the sort of homespun feel good.
Right,
message.
So there's no wax on, wax off here.
There's not really.
His chest, which
no, there's a lot of tattoos and a lot of kind of you know, grazes on face.
Yeah. So you've got a big UK star, big Australian star, but this is a big. This is all the cheese of a Hollywood movie.
It is, and you've got Nick Nolte as the gravelly old dad.
he's always the gravelly old dad.
He's always the gravelly old dad now, isn't it?
Or granddad, I suppose he is now.
Yeah, yeah, and when he's not getting kind of busted.
So is he that kind of Burgess Meredith in Rocky kind of role?
There is a lot of Rocky to this film. And as with Rocky, I guess, there's this sense that it's almost two films kind of shackled together. Mm. So you've got these two very, very good actors who have a kind of weight and an authority and a slight sort of, you know, method acting school of kind of intensity. Mm. But they're kind of shackled to this pure cheese plotline. And eventually it sort of pulls apart. I mean, we know exactly where it's going. It's going to the ring where they've got to kind of square off against
each
other.
This is a cage fighting. This is not boxing. That's the twist, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, do you know
there's
the rules of cage fighting?
I don't. There's no rules of cage fighting.
No rules are there. Ain't no rules.
It's like, you know, yeah. Okay. One man's coming out alive.
Right. Now we shall turn to the ring of love, Zan, where Mademoiselle Chambon.
Your links are just like,
you know what,
poetry,
I mean?
Aren't
they? It really is. It's Dave Lee Travis. Would he's got nothing on me. Mademoiselle Chambon, which is a French movie starring Sandrine Kiberlain and Vincent Landon, or Sandrine Kiberlain and Vincent Landon. He's a sort of careworn builder who suddenly falls in love with his son's elegant, I think she's a French teacher, but she also plays the violin, and this seems to be something, a beauty he's never come across before.
Bon, qu'est-ce qui se passe, Jean? Ah, t'es où, là?
Moi, je suis où?
Strikes me that this is in the sort of vein of, we had Kristen Scott Thomas being all kind of, she was the posh woman who left for the beefy builder in Partier. There seems to be a sort of thing going on in France about build. Maybe it's the builders.
It's a slight Lady Chatterley Mellors thing as well, where he's the horny handed.
Which they also remade in the French, didn't they, Pascal?
They Farrow did, yeah, Lady a couple of years ago, which is very good. Yeah. I thought this was great, actually. I mean, it's one of those films that it's a hard sell because, you know, not a whole lot happens.
Sort of nothing happens
apart from they occasionally, you know, he goes around and puts a window in her apartment and she plays the violin and he stares at her and she says, oh, I can lend you a CD of that violin bit.
It's Elgar, I believe.
I think it's Elgar. And then there's a party for his old dad near the end where she plays the violin again.
He turns up and plays the violin.
Yeah. And that's kind of it. Mm. And yet it's sort of nothing, but it's everything as well. And the two performances I thought were absolutely,
I mean, that's
superb.
The thing here. Aren't they both brilliant? I mean, her in particular, I thought she was just outstanding. Yeah. I've always quite liked her. She's a strange sort of...
What else has she been in?
She's a gazelle, a giraffe. She's been in stuff, loads of stuff.
I did like her in stuff.
Yeah.
And I know I've seen Vincent Landon in stuff
in many
as well.
Stuff. He's kind of, his star has risen of late. He was in a couple of things at Cannes. He was in that strange two-hander called Pater. Mm. And then he was in that one where he had to spring Diane Kruger from jail. Anything for Her?
Oh, that was
remade. He was remade as Russell Crowe by Paul Haggis.
Yeah. And it's just those performances where nothing is said but everything's said. Mm. That he's, you know, inarticulate, family man. And yet he knows what's at stake. That basically this affair, if it is even is an affair, is doomed and is going to have a terrible kind of catastrophic consequence within this little goldfish bowl of this small town France. I'm not sure where it was. It looked like somewhere in the Massif Central or something.
It was. I think it was very odd to work out because they have a train station in there, but they never show you the name of the train station. I looked in the credits.
And occasionally they go outside of the town and everything is very windy. Yeah. So you think, oh, this is somewhere in the mountains.
And it is, they're sort of trapped in this town because it's, you see, he goes to his favourite viewpoint and they're in this kind of bowl, this valley. So it's very much this kind of pressure cooker place, except where everyone's very relaxed and kind of, you know, tootling around in that place where Gerard Depardieu did that My Afternoons with Marguerite place.
It is a bit like that. Yeah, he kept expecting Marguerite to pop up.
Yeah, I did. She was probably sitting in a square somewhere going, tut, tut. I had a problem with him because his character, I mean, his wife is pregnant and yet he's kind of falling for the elegant violin teacher.
But when it comes.
This is it, doesn't it?
Doesn't it?
It's very French.
And there's just definitely this sense that these people are, you know, their dramas are playing out below the parapet of sort of everyday life, that, you know, the town's carrying on and the family business is still being attended to, and there's these great kind of cataclysmic bombs going off in their lives, but yet nobody's aware of them, and almost the viewer isn't aware of them, that you're having to kind of attune and acclimatise to this very delicate world. But when you do, I thought it was a great little film.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those ones to discover, and you'll come away going, why isn't anyone talking about this film? It's a little private little gem, so go and have that experience. I would recommend it as well. Lovely song at the end played by Barbara called Quel Joli Temps, which was I loved, a kind of a torch song, kind of chanteurs, kind of Edith Piafi thing. And it finishes it. It is just beautiful. And if you get the lyrics, listen, translate them, it sums up the film absolutely brilliantly. Mademoiselle Chambon. Zan, very nice to see you. Film of the week?
I think it's still got to be Drive. I feel terrible saying that because you've got this small film that does deserve your attention. But I think just for pure kind of pleasure, maybe Drive.
Indeed. And for a comprehensive list of film reviews on all this week's releases and so much more, go to the best film site in the webosphere, guardian.co.uk/film.
He never said to me, I'm gonna die. But I knew. So I'd write him letters. You know, I wanted to stay, and his brother said to me, you can't, you have to go. Because if you stay, he'll know that you know something's really wrong. And it was very hard to accept. And it was
That's Liza Minnelli there in a scene from a documentary that explores a forgotten fashion icon. And in Liza's case, a very close friend. She wore a yellow Holston dress to accept her Oscar for Cabaret. And it was designed by the late designer Roy Halston Froick. The film is called Ultra Suede, In Search of Halston. And joining me to help find him is the director of that documentary, Whitney Sudler-Smith. Welcome to Film Weekly, Whitney.
Hi, thank you so much. Hi, how are you?
I'm really good, thank you. It's nice to have you here. Nice to mark Fashion Week as well with a man who made a film about a fashion icon.
Thank you. It's been an honor. A couple of shows. Went to Temperley the other night, which is brilliant.
Right.
Yeah.
Is it what fashion drew you into searching for Halston? Because I got to tell you, before your film, I didn't know about Halston.
Well, I didn't really know much either, and I'm not really know much about women's fashion. It was just that initially I wanted to do a great film about kind of the great eras of decadence in history.
Mm.
You know, Paris in the 20s, Berlin in the 30s, London in the 60s, and New York in the 70s. And who better to represent that was Halston. You know, Studio 54 and Warhol and the drugs, disco. And so it kind of went into that. But the more I kind of learned about his life, the more I kind of figured, well, it's kind of appropriate to do a real story about him. And he has an amazing story. Kind
of I mean, I was watching your film. Of course, when I saw the clothes, of course, I completely went, oh, he made, I mean, that was such a look, that Studio 54 look, the kind of like wide-brim hats, the kind of very simple colours. But how do you describe the clothes? Because obviously we're an audio show here, so we've got no, but how do you describe them?
It's a very good question. Kind of simple, one-piece minimalist. You know, one strap, kind of a shirtwaist dress.
Shirtwaist, yeah.
You know, he kind of represented the style of the 70s. Mm. He's kind of disco, Studio 54 look.
Yeah, so if we think of some people that kind of wore that stuff, we're thinking, who would you say was the kind of, you know, the top purveyor of Halston? Well, Liza Minnelli and all her glittery stage gear.
Yeah, just any model that went to Studio 54, Bianca Jagger.
Angelica Houston probably being the most famous of them all.
She was. She was one of his first models. And he kind of gave her start, and she did all of his modeling and so forth. And she kind of decided that, you know, modeling was not for her. She wanted to be a great actress. So Halston encouraged her to, you know, strike it out in Hollywood.
So I mean, you there's a bit in your film where you're going along Fashion Avenue in New York, and there's plaques on the pavement. I've been there myself. Sure. I didn't notice Halston's one, but it says the 70s belonged to Halston.
It's
a brilliant kind of. he would have been very proud of that little moniker.
I think so. Yeah, it's kind of like the Walk of Stars in Hollywood, but just for all the fashion greats. And essentially, yeah, the 70s did belong to Halston. He kind of represented, I mean, especially in New York, which is a great era in American history, where in New York City you had, you know, crime, drugs, prostitution were endemic.
Yeah, because we're thinking of Taxi Driver on one side.
Yeah, exactly. But it's had this great kind of cultural explosion with fashion and art and music.
And disco.
And disco. And, you know, and Halston kind of represented that, the fashion part. And the decadence part too.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously there's a kind of search in there. Halston is no longer with us, obviously.
Yes.
But in a way, your film kind of builds him up, and you know, he almost, there's something of the Bond villain about him from what I've seen in your film. That kind of always clad in black, massive offices with New York behind him. I imagine him, stroking an ultra suede cat.
Yeah, he's quite sinister. He really put people ill at ease and. You know, having kind of a cocaine hangover and being quite, you know, testy does not help things either. But he was a bit sinister. I mean, supposedly everyone says he was very generous and nice, but also said he's very kind of haughty and incredibly mean and very intimidating, just because he was just so so dark. You know, he had a lot of demons.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's the gay scene as well in New York, which exploded at that time. And he was kind of, was he kind of part of that? I mean, there were lots of kind of pictures of people in that, you know, denim hot pants. And his great boyfriend, Victor Hugo. Victor Hugo.
Who's just a great figure. Yeah, that was his boyfriend. And
great moustache he had.
He had a great moustache. I wish I could kind of, you know, get that moustache going. It was just, yeah, I mean, it was New York, late 70s, pre-AIDS, and kind of the sexual gay revolution was going on. Mm. And obviously Halston and his boyfriend kind of took full advantage of, you know, that whole atmosphere. And really, you know, and again, it was before Reagan came to office and ruined everything.
So, well, it was Reagan that did it rather than AIDS.
I think it was a combination of both.
Yeah, that's a toxic combination, right?
Yeah.
Ultra suede was a material. Is that still around? Can we
it
still
is.
Get things out?
You can still get it.
He seemed to cover New York in ultra suede, not over the curves of his models.
That's right.
But his deep conversation pits in his amazing house were all ultra suede.
Everything's ultra suede. It's like suede, but you can spill drinks on it and you put it in the washing machine. It's indestructible.
Right. Wait, so why isn't everything in ultra suede? Why aren't my pants ultra suede?
You should have ultra suede.
I'm going to get some.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. But at the time, it was this revolutionary fabric, which he made famous. And his shirt waist dress was made in ultra suede and is the biggest selling dress of all time to this day.
Wow.
So everyone wore it. Even Betty Ford, the, you know, wife of the president, wore it. And it's just you know, kind of an iconic dress.
Yeah, I mean, how cool to have invented that. And himself, he was that jacket that he wore kind of...
He wore a lot of kind of ultra suede jackets. Yeah. But he was always wore black slacks, black turtleneck, red socks, strangely, and then sometimes like a gray ultra suede jacket.
Yeah, it's kind of a decent look.
Very cool, yeah.
You know, if you were making...
Oh, and sunglasses in the daytime.
Oh, you've got to wear sunglasses.
Mirrored.
Yeah, exactly. So no one can see into your soul, lest they don't like what they see there. Now, I like going into Liza Minnelli's apartment that Halston himself designed.
Yeah, that was amazing. You
That's
went in
a
there.
Big apartment.
Well, you walked into Liza Minnelli's apartment, and the first thing you see, which is so intimidating, are hand-painted Warhols of her mother, Vincent Minnelli. You know, probably, I don't know, $1 billion worth of art just right there facing you as you walk in.
I would have in my downstairs toilet.
Yeah, I mean, really. And she's incredibly intimidating as well. I mean, any woman that chain smokes Carlton 100s is terrifying.
Hard to edit as well. Well done on the continuity there. Yeah, I really enjoyed seeing her and Angelica Houston and Billy Joel and all of those people that are in there. The one thing I did think was in my search for Halston throughout your film.
Sure.
I was wondering, did he really exist? Was there really a man called Halston? I kept thinking it was a bit Zelig, like, you know, you could have invented him and photoshopped him in and popped him up. Was there a guy called Halston?
Absolutely. I mean, again, he was this mythical character that in today's world would never exist or would be dead. He was just someone that, you know, this brief, incredible moment in time that was emblematic of this era. And, you know, you can never kind of recreate a character like this, I don't think. Well, maybe, I mean, just to a lesser degree, maybe Marc Jacobs or Tom Ford, who I think definitely inspired by Halston, you know, with the orchids and kind of that naughty and haughty kind of sensibility.
Tom Ford has done menswear. He's only just started. I think in this London Fashion Week, he's showing his first women's wear collection.
Oh, yeah. Did you see it? How was it?
No, I didn't. None of that fits me anymore. When I was a younger man, maybe.
Yeah.
But he did Julianne Moore for that film, A Single Man, with Colin Firth.
That's right.
Julianne Moore was, and she was in our film Crazy Stupid Love this week. So it all does tie together like a shirt waist dress belted around the waist.
100%. Exactly.
Whitney Sudler-Smith, thank you so much for coming and telling us about Halston. I really enjoyed your documentary, actually.
Well, thank you. I'm really glad you loved it. Yeah,
giddily enthusiastic, and anything with a kind of slap that baseline Nile Rodgers thing going on.
Thank you.
I'm there.
Please come see it. It's a big camp. It's a lot of fun. It's informative and just kind of gives the whole story of 70s fashion, disco, and drugs.
A bit camp and a lot of fun, almost describing Film Weekly.
Exactly. Great. Thank you.
Ultra Suede in Search of Halston is on general release here in the UK from this Friday, the 23rd of September. And that's all we've got for you this week. The music we've been featuring on this week's show is, of course, from that fabulous Drive soundtrack, with the score by Cliff Martinez and performances from people such as College. Well worth picking up a copy and, of course, entering our competition to win it. And another copy you should pick up is, of course, The Observer this weekend for my Trailer Trash column and the inside track on the best film news and reviews to be found in any Sunday paper, of course. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's time we got into our car and drove away. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.